I think when we talk about Chinese culture in the adoption community, we have to be really careful because culture is a learned thing. It's not innate, and it's not whatever you want it to be. You can't teach a language that you don't speak fluently, and you can't pass on a culture that you've never lived, which means that if we want our kids to have some connection to Chinese culture, we have to connect them to Chinese people. And a lot of times, white adoptive parents get very, very excited about Chinese culture for their kids, but it's created in a context where the vast majority of adults are white. And a few Chinese people, usually immigrants, are imported into that gathering to give very stereotyped Chinese folk things, so paper cutting or Chinese dance or whatever. And never outside this range of very folkloric museum culture kinds of things. That's not Chinese culture. There are many ways to be Chinese in this country, none of which I can be. None of which white parents can be or can deliver. There are lots and lots of variations on being Chinese in America, but it really needs to be delivered by someone who's lived that and who has chosen a way to be Chinese in America, either to carry on lots of traditions from their family's history or selected traditions, whereas others they don't like so much and they don't carry those on, or none. That's also a way that people are Chinese in this country, speaking only English and not really celebrating holidays. All of those are possible, but they come in the context of a family and a community. And we white parents can't just make it up and get together with 100 or 200 or 500 Chinese children in the center of a circle with white parents all around and dress them up in, Chinese traditional clothes and have them do Chinese dances and call that Chinese culture. It isn't. It's some kind of, it's a collection of white stereotypes of Chinese culture that are completely removed from a living culture. And I think that that's not going to do the trick for our kids, because sooner or later they will grow up and they'll leave and they'll go off to college. And in this country, that means they're going to be around Asian students. And they're going to find out that what they've learned that's supposedly Chinese is doesn't ring true for anybody that they meet. And that concerns me a lot. I think that's not going to feel very good. I think we have to, our children need Asian American, Chinese American adults in their lives. A variety, there are different ways to be Asian in this country. They need role models who are adults, who have grown up in families that have brought traditional practices to this country and live them in whatever way they live them, so that our kids have some choices that are grounded in real life, and particularly in this community, not every Chinese girl wants to do Chinese folk dance. What if your child wants to do ballet, classical ballet? Well, that can be done in a Chinese context in a city like San Francisco, but white parents tend not to look for classical ballet in the Chinese community. They tend not to look for Western classical instruments, although gazillions of Chinese American kids play violin and piano and all that. It wouldn't be hard to find a Chinese American or Asian American piano teacher. But generally speaking, white parents won't think of those activities as Asian American activities. And then you have to say, well, what does that say about our children as Asian Americans? They need the full range of possibilities that any other American child has. They shouldn't be pushed into stereotyped activities or kept from traditional Chinese activities. They will develop likes and dislikes. And in places like San Francisco or, you know, a handful of other cities in this country where there's a large enough Asian American community, whatever your child's interests are can be found in that community, which puts them in touch with other kids who look like them, who are doing those things, whether it's soccer or ballet or piano. It doesn't have to be a folk art, you know. That's not how everybody lives here. So I worry about that piece. And I also think we white parents tend to think of Chinese identity as something that belongs only to China. It's scary to think that our children will be a different kind of American than we are, but they will be. Even if we protect them from that when they live with us, they can sort of live in the white world if that's what we choose to do to them. But sooner or later, they go out into the world, and they are a different kind of American than we are. This is a very race-conscious society. Nobody will accept that they are white children, white young adults, when they go out in the world. And we need to prepare them for adulthood in every sense, and that means they need to know who they are. And a lot of kids grow up in white families and go out into the world and only then begin to think, oh my God, look at that face, you know, what does that mean? And that means that they're starting that search at 18, 19, you know, that's really sad. So I think we have to embrace really a triple identity for our kids. That is, they are American of whatever form we happen to be, sometimes more than one kind, and they're entitled to participate in our cultural inheritance as well, and the mainstream American culture, whatever that is, and however we participate in it. They are Chinese born. They are entitled to recognize and be and honor that heritage, which is theirs. That's where they were born. That's, you know, where they come from. But also their Chinese American, Asian American identity. That's a piece they're going to have to develop, and it seems to be the one that's hardest for white parents, most threatening.
I asked the Yang Yang about that, but it seems like I didn't ask directly whether you feel racist and things like that, but she seems like, you know, nobody's staring at me, you know, even though she's with the white parents. So it seems like she's quite protected in this area, but
yes. Yes.
But sooner or later, as you said, she should be exposed. So you said we need to prepare, but how do you prepare?
Yes. It's, well, it's tough. I mean, you know, in some ways it's such a it's so great for Asian American kids in this city. If they're in a school where they're in the majority, they don't have to deal with that kind of overt racism as young children, and that gives us time to teach and to give them some skills. But Terry and I mean, as white people in this country, we don't have that experience to give. So what we do is, you know, for Ying Ying, the real teacher on that front is her godparents, who are Chinese, American-born Chinese, multiple generations, and they've looked this stuff in the eye. They grew up here, so they know that as a child it feels pretty comfortable most of the time, but they're also very clear about what happens, and it's very important to them to teach their daughter and also their goddaughter what racism is like for Asians in this country and what the history of that experience is. So again, this is something we can talk about, but we can't really teach that because we haven't experienced that. We didn't have to negotiate that here. We did have to negotiate it to an extent in China, but you know, I was just talking about this with a Chinese friend. It's different when it's not your country. You know, we were in China for a little over 2 years. We always knew we were leaving. You know, if people said nasty things to us, it wasn't in our primary language, it was in our secondary language, and it was in our country. And you know, there are lots of ways in which that experience isn't the same as being a minority person in your own country and being treated in a racist way. So while it gives us some insight into what it feels like to be called names and have your kids told that, you know, if you don't behave, the foreigners will eat you or whatever it is. It doesn't have that, the power that it has if it's your own country and your own primary language that these things are being said in. So yes, I mean, kids growing up here in San Francisco or growing up in Monterey Park or growing up in Hawaii probably do, as Asian American kids, experience less racism than kids in other parts of the country. And I hope that it gives them a chance to get on their feet and be proud of who they are before they get it knocked out of them. But I think it is important for them to be prepared for racism when it comes. And if that's put off a few years, maybe they'll be better at handling it. But again, I think you need role models who have lived it and who have good strategies that they're teaching their own children and to be the teachers for our children.
Sorry.
Oh no, yeah. I'm fine.
You talk more.
No. That's okay. Yeah. You like to move around. I think my next question is, it seems like you are learning a lot from Korean adult adoptees or maybe from their adoptive parents. Just, could you tell me what kind of things you are learning from them?
One of the most comforting things to us is the knowledge that other people have been here before, and that that particularly a lot of the Korean American adoptees are making themselves available to tell us what it was like for them if we'll only just listen, and they're able to articulate things that are our children at pre-adolescent and adolescent range can't say to us yet. These people who, the history of Korean adoption, you know, goes back 50 years now. And there's just a tremendous amount of embodied knowledge that is telling us things that are important, that that race is important, that being open about adoption is important, that the culture is important, and just forming all those types of identity are really important. We're listening to those things, that simply loving a child is not enough. When we made the choice to take a child out of the country of her birth, we took on a responsibility, and we take that as an obligation to bring her up to understand who she is and all of that, instead of shying away from that elephant in the living room. Those are some of the things that we've gotten from the transracial international adoption community, mostly from the adoptees. I think their experience of adoption is something that we can't No, they can tell us all the things that their parents did wrong or that they wish they might have done differently. The parents are open, and they're all, the ones, actually there are quite a few that are trained adoption professionals and are in counseling that are extremely astute in their observations. What they can say is, oh yeah, here's the things that I wish I would have done differently. It's we just soak it up like a sponge, and try to do the things that will make it a less bumpy ride for our kids, we hope. And knowing that we can't solve one of the things that's a very important thing that we've heard is to know that we can't solve everything. There's a time when we can only listen and support our kids when they're dealing with some big issues that, as parents, we would love to be able to fix, but we can't.
Yeah, well, I was thinking in particular of direct information that's come from adult adoptees to our children, both in personal interactions, in groups and workshops and things. It's just incredible generosity of spirit you know, for Korean adoptees, they don't have to do this. They don't do it for us, but they don't have to do it for our kids. They're not Korean, you know. But there's a compassion and a real desire to make it easier for the next generation and to help the next generation cope with the really big, unfixable things. I value that so much, and I know that our children will too. They kind of take it for granted now, but I guess that's the way it should be. But I think of even things like Tian Bo-shae Lim's film. You know, she taught Ying-Ying that she has two real mothers. That's from that film. And Ying used to, at a very, like 6 or 7, she'd stand in front of the television with that tape going, and there's a section where Tian is first with her American mother, and her American mother says, oh, I just raised you, but she gave birth to you. She's your real mother. And then in the next scene, she's with her Korean mother, and her Korean mother says, oh, I just gave birth to you. She raised you. She's your real mother. And Ying-Ying would stand there and just say, they're both your real mothers. You know, what a gift. What an incredible gift that is. Because in the societies that we live in, East or West, everyone tells children you have only one mother. And that's not true for our children. They have at least two. Some have more, you know. But to have a beautifully crafted film like Deanne's and some others that we've seen, but especially that one because it spoke to a very young child who couldn't sit and listen to all the talk. But she got that. And that was one of the most important messages of that film, is that they're both real and our kids are entitled to own their whole selves and all of their families, both or all of their families. And I think we would not have gotten there on our own, or it would have taken us a very, very long time without the experience of the Korean adoptees and their openness and their willingness to come out and just tell their truth. A lot of times that's really hard for us parents of younger kids to hear. Really hard. We don't want it to be like that. It isn't, you know, horrible for everybody, but for some it has been horrible. And I think for my part, I want to know the whole range of possibilities, because I'm sure these were all adorable, cute little kids too. And we can't predict which of our children are going to have a really hard time in adolescence and early adulthood. We just can't know that up front. And I feel as a parent, the better I can understand the whole range of what I hear, including the really difficult stuff, that I'm going to be able to be there for my child, whatever she's going through, that she won't have to be perfect. She won't have to be completely happy with her life. She can, you know, spend some time raging if that's what she needs to do. There's plenty to rage at. And I think I've learned a lot from the difficult testimony. And I hope that, I hope it's not that hard for my child, but I'm not convinced that it's simply a generational thing, that, you know, these Korean adoptees went through it and our kids won't. I think some of our kids will too. We just don't know which ones yet. There's some really hard things about this way to be brought up in the world, and some kids are going to have a hard time with it.
I think there's one other little thing that I've gotten, and that is, in the same sense that it's important to have an adult role model who is Chinese, who's Asian American in our daughter's life, it's every bit as important to have an adult adoptee as a role model in her life, someone who understands what it feels like to be adopted and who can talk with her about, yeah, I know what it feels like. It's every bit as important for that part of her identity to have a role model as an adult, a successful person whom she respects, who understands a part of her in a way that we can't because we haven't been there. And that's another big thing that we've gotten from this community.
when I talk to young adoptees at the young adoptee preteen mm-hmm. adoptee gathering, mm-hmm. we asked what message you'd like to give it to your adoptive parents, and a lot of kids said that advice to adoptive parents,
yes.
not specifically about their parents, but they said, you know, remind their children that they are adopted
yes.
yeah, when they're young. So I was just, I didn't ask questions,
yeah.
but why do you think they said that? How did you remind Ying Ying?
These kids are growing up in San Francisco with a lot of, they know same race adoptees, and in some cases I think they all know kids who are adopted from China in same race families that don't talk about it. So in some ways they do, it's different here, you know, that quite a lot of Chinese Americans in San Francisco have adopted from China, and that's a bit different from the Korean experience. I don't think there were too many Korean Americans adopting from Korea. Maybe that's changing now, but the numbers are quite large. So our kids are all in school with kids that they know to be adopted in families where they can pass, and a lot of families do try to hush-hush, and then the kids, you know, kind of wonder what's wrong with them, you know, what's so bad about me being born in China, and why do my parents tell people I was born in San Francisco? Why do they tell them that I wasn't adopted, you know, that I was mm-hmm. born to them?
Why are they ashamed?
It starts to feel like it's shameful. So I that's my guess of why they were saying that. I wonder if kids in some other part of the country would say that. And if they would, I don't know. I mean, maybe it's because we really value openness. But when you're a transracial family, it's on the table. I mean, you can't, if you don't deal with it, it really is that elephant in the living room. You have to deal with what's different because it's right up front. And maybe that's why, you know, maybe they know kids in transracial families where the parents, you know, there is this kind of myth that you'll hear sometimes from white adoptive parents that, oh, color doesn't matter. I mean, that's nonsense. And they wouldn't be saying that if they weren't white, because nobody else thinks that, as far as I could tell. But, you know, there are some parents who say, oh, she doesn't look Chinese to me. You know, and that's a real scary thing, because we have to find points of connection with our kids, of course, and the ways that we're alike really, really matter and bind our kids to our families and us to them and them to us. But they don't cancel out their differences, you know. And if you ignore those differences or try to cover them up, you really are risking putting space between yourself and your child, especially as they get older. They just won't tolerate that anymore. So I guess maybe it's some of each. Maybe they've heard some of each.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think there's also a very bit of practical advice in giving the parents comfort in talking about adoption and adoption issues. It's one of the things we heard, one of the very first pieces of practical advice we got from our agency, that when you come back and your baby's in the crib, talk to them about your birth mother, not because they'll understand it, they won't, but you'll get comfortable with the idea of it. And I think a lot of adoptive parents, in their own mind, perhaps because of the route that they got to adoption by going through a painful route themselves, they assign some pejorative values or some negative values to adoption. Society has some stigmas attached to adoption. It's not a normal family or a natural family. And by talking about it, it just becomes more normal for everyone and a lot more comfortable. It's easier for the kids to understand that it's a part of them that they needn't be ashamed of.
Could you tell me how old Ying Ying was when you first adopted and how you brought up the issue of birth mother and adoption?
Pardon? The second half?
Oh, how we brought it up?
Yeah.
The issue of...
Oh, yeah. Well, she was...
Pictures. I mean, I guess yeah. when yeah, she adopted
sure.
when she was a baby.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So maybe she didn't know whether she's adopted. She
yeah.
Baby.
No.
She didn't. And then you have to bring it up, why she was born
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah, she was, well, she was 4.5 months, so she didn't, you know, she didn't remember anything. So we...
Could you make a sentence when I adopted her, she was...
When we adopted her, she was 4.5 months old, so she couldn't talk in any language, and she was really very little. But I think we practiced, as many parents practice, we told her the story of her adoption. And somebody was an adoptive parent who'd adopted from Romania a few years before we adopted, and I met her online back in a long time ago, and she gave me this great advice, which I was very lucky to run into because I wouldn't have thought of it, and that is that we must start the story of our children's lives when they were born, just like everybody else, because a lot of adopted kids are 6 or 7 years old. They think they were never born. They were just adopted. Everybody else knows that they were born, and they were adopted. And so that gave me a sort of structure to be able to start her story always with growing in her birth mother's tummy, is how I used to say. It doesn't mean anything to an 8-month-old baby, but it was great practice for me. And that way, as pieces of the story made sense to her as she grew older, there was never a time when she felt like the story suddenly changed to include this person. It always began with being, you know, growing inside her birth mother's tummy and getting bigger and bigger, and finally she was ready to come out, and boom, she was born. And then there were 10 weeks and we don't know what happened because we don't have any trace of that. Maybe she was with her birth family and maybe she was with some other people. All we know is that they took really good care of her. And then, and we know that because she's incredibly healthy. I mean, she obviously had a good start, good genes and a good start. She's very, very healthy. Then we know she was at the orphanage for 10 weeks and we knew a certain amount about that. And then we talked about, you know, and then we started to adopt to the adoption process and we waited so long and all that. But, you know, kids love to hear the story of their beginnings, whether, you know, it starts with mommy rushing to the hospital in the snowstorm, or in our case, I had just gotten that excellent piece of advice to start the story at birth, just like every other child, you know, and I think that it would have taken me years to get to that one, really years. I would never have thought of it myself. So I think that was really great. And by talking about that before she could possibly understand it, it gave us years of practice with this stuff so that by the time, you know, she started to understand, and really, kids can't understand adoption until they can understand the fundamentals of reproduction, that there's a mom and a dad involved here somewhere that bring them into the world, and it wasn't us. There's not some moment when suddenly they realize that there must have been someone else involved in their story somewhere. And it was always out there. And I think that way, kids ease into their understanding. But it's never over, you know, because at each stage of cognitive development, they understand their story in a different way, and they have to reinterpret it and rethink it, because it gets denser and richer and actually more difficult as they get older. And I think, you know, maybe it takes being an adult to really understand how a grown-up could have such a difficult problem that they could choose not to raise a baby born to them. I'm not sure that's something a preteen or a teenager can possibly understand or forgive. Not really, because everything tells our children that their mother who brought them into the world should have done anything for them. And so I think it's a lifelong thing. If it isn't half a life, it's a whole lifelong to really come to terms with the difficulties of that story. But that's the real story. I mean, that's the real thing. And it's not like our kids are doomed to misery because they had a really rough beginning. At the same time, that really rough beginning changed everything. They would be completely different people. And that starts to hit them around this preteen age. That it's not just that they'd be speaking a different primary language. They'd be a different person if they'd grown up in their birth country, you know. And that's a big, big thing to try to grasp at this age.
Okay, it's almost done, but I have a few questions. It's a very rare opportunity to have a, you know, people like this. So. So, shall we talk about FCC? I think you're members there, right? So, what kind of, why the purpose, why you join them, and what kind of activity do you do?
What is FCC? Could you say that?
Yeah. FCC's families with children from China. The first chapter of FCC started back on the East Coast, and several other chapters started up as adoption from China became more prevalent. There are more than 100 chapters in North America now, so it's quite widespread. And it's essentially a network of families. Most of these started up through finding each other through through the adoption agencies and through webs and the ability to talk on the internet. And it from starting as a network of families, most started with the ideals of providing resources to themselves for families who are looking for more information about adoption, either ones that are considering adoption or who have adoptive children and are looking for resources, answers, connections to communities. And it's a network. And starting very soon after some of the first FCCs were incorporated as nonprofits, a lot of the families started giving back to China as well. And there's national campaigns that FCCs organize jointly to send money back to China to help out in some of the orphanages that are just short on resources. There, many of them are overburdened, and the things that the FCC community can do to give back to the children who still remain in orphanages has been a really heartwarming story. It's one of the things that those connections have allowed Ying Ying to channel royalties from her book through those same connections to pay for the fees of school children in her orphanage. Those are some of the things that FCC has enabled through making some of those connections.
And could you tell me, I don't know what to ask. I ask so many questions, so let me think. Did you talk about your visit to China and orphanages with the Indian? Is there anything
Actually, there is something interesting about taking her back to China, because we wanted to take her back often, early and often, partly because we wanted China to be a normal place to her. That was the first thing. It was a place where we had lived, and we knew lots of families lived there. And we didn't want it to be some big, scary, horrible place. We love to travel. Terry was traveling a lot for work at that time, so we had gazillions of frequent flyer miles, so it wasn't a hardship to go overseas. And we, as soon as she had an American passport at age 4, we took her back for the first time. Also at 4, we thought she might possibly retain some memories. And China was changing so fast in the early to mid-1990s. We just wanted to have some baseline pictures of her in the country while it still looked sort of like what it looked like when she was there, because it's not like that now, not in the cities. But at that time, she was very frightened that she was aware of the birth mother thing very early. And at 4, she was really scared that somehow her birth mother would find her and take her away, which is the typical fear at 4, 5, 6 years of age. Now, of course, her birth mother would come and take her away and her life would be perfect. That's more the 10, 11-year-old thing. But at 4, she was quite frightened of it. And so, we said, well, we're not going to your part. We're not going to the part of China where you lived. We're going to go visit our friends. And we're going to come home. We talked a lot about what we were going to do when we got back. And so she went, and she had a great time. She was already bilingual, and it was really exciting for her to hear Mandarin coming out of loudspeakers and out of people talking around her, and children's songs that she knew from school, and she felt really cozy. I mean, we knew we had friends who had kids who took a great interest in her, and she went to rides, and she just had a really good time, went to the zoo, and she
felt entitled, and she still does.
And she just really enjoyed it. And we hung out with families who took her into their homes and cooked for her and you know, just included her, and then we'd send her out to play with the kids. You know, she didn't speak that much Chinese then, but she understood everything, and so we could just let her go with the kids. And we wanted her to have that as the first experience. And when we dealt with orphanages later, we didn't take her back to Hunan, to her orphanage, until she wanted to. And that was really after Dan's film had come out, and she'd seen it a couple of times, and she wanted to do that. She did come with me on a trip to see some orphanage assistance projects in another province. And actually, at those orphanages, I think that the scare went out of, you know, at that age, again, kids don't walk into an orphanage and think, my God, no parents, you know. They just see a whole bunch of kids having fun because they only see them for an hour or so at a time. And she went to four or five orphanages in Hubei province, and there were kids, and they were playing, and they were singing, and, you know, they had a little preschool class, and it looked normal to her. She didn't think about how they didn't go home at night, you know. She just saw them in the present, and that was enough. So that began the process of, I want to go to my orphanage. And then once we did it once, then we had to come back the next year and bring everybody the books. And we've taken other families who've adopted from Changsha and other places and taken them back. And we try to take families out into the countryside. I mean, we're small groups, these are friends, and we really like to get the kids out into the countryside, because modern city life in China is so first world in so many ways. It's hard for our kids to understand what life is like for most rural people unless they actually get out there and get in somebody's home and see the dirt floor and the holes in the ceiling and the, you know, the single light bulb and all that kind of stuff. There's a huge, huge gap between urban life and deep rural life, which is, you know, our kids most likely come from rural families. And that's been a really important part of what we've done in taking her back. We just in April took her and some other kids to a middle school in way out in the countryside. So they were with kids their age or a little bit older who were at a boarding school trying to catch up with city kids, basically, so that they would have a chance of maybe getting into college when they're older. And these kids go to school 6.5 days a week, and they go home one afternoon a month, you know. And all summer when they go home, they work in the fields. I mean, this is a really different life from what our kids have. And they all can't wait to get back to school because that's their ticket out, and they know it. So I think as she gets older, we want to keep her connected to China, keep building relationships with people that she sees every couple of years, and also keep building that database of experiences outside the cities to build understanding and ultimately, I hope, compassion for the pressures and difficulties of rural life.
And I think one more thing I need to ask about is she's really extraordinary. She published a book when she was 8, you know. But I think she did that with your help.
Sure.
And also she talked about adoption issues and, you know, everything. So is there anything we should know about, you know, her publishing book?
Sure. I can talk about how we did. When we put the book together, what we did is sort of like what you do when you make a quilt. She obviously, at 7 years old, she couldn't structure a book. She couldn't sit down and write a manuscript. I mean, there's no way she could do that. My aim was to, she really wanted to tell her own story her way. That's what she got out of Diane Boucher Lim's film, and that's what she wanted to accomplish. So that was our goal. It had to ring true to her. It had to be in her language. What I provided was a structure. The photographer provided 1,500 photographs, which she never saw them all. It was too many at that age. She couldn't deal with that. So we got it down to about 200. And then I sat with the designer and we got it down to about the 100 that are in the book. And I made the structure for it. So each section, and divided up the photographs. So we did that sort of scaffolding work or the quilting, you know, the frame of the quilt was constructed by adults and professional. I'm a book editor, and the designer is a book designer. I mean, this is what we do. And the designer is her godfather, so he takes a very personal interest in her as well. And then what we did for each section is look at those photographs separately, and I interviewed her and taped her talking about the pictures, what she remembered. So we had that on tape. She had her teachers, both English and Chinese, had asked her to keep a diary of her trip. So we had her writing in English and Chinese. We had videotape, because a lot of the time that the photographer was going, we were videotaping. So we had, so we'd watch the videotape, and she would talk about that. And from those various pieces, I put together a rather lengthy typescript that I then broke up into pieces, and we put it down on the floor with the pictures. And she added and subtracted things that she thought should be in that section. She wanted to comment on this photograph or that photograph, and we changed that all around. And then it was all too big. So we had to cut about a fifth of the text. And she helped to do that. And she was also very involved, actually, in the line editing of the final manuscript, because when she saw it on, you know, I had text next to the photographs that would appear on each page, she would get a feeling of, you know, that it was giving a message she hadn't intended, and she would adjust the wording so that, you know, there was something about before I was adopted, I was just Chinese, or I was only Chinese, whatever it was. She thought it made it sound like being Chinese wasn't good enough. You had to be American too. So she changed the just to only, or only to just, I don't even remember. But it was that kind of thing where she was really engaged with trying to control the message that she was given, but that she was giving out. But sure, yes, professional book people, including myself, we put that book together. But the pieces of that built book quilt are her design. Those are her words and her feelings, and not mine. I mean, a lot of it, I don't see it that way at all. Maybe when she's older, she won't see it quite that way at all. The hardest section by far for her, and the section that has almost no words in it, is with the disabled kids. They're very, very, very severely disabled children. We don't see those kids in everyday life here in the United States. I mean, she really was not prepared, and we had not prepared her for the extent of these children's disabilities. She didn't know what to think of that. And we did have someone. One of the Amity Foundation was with us when she first saw the disabled kids, and she pretty much used what Anand told her, which was that their lives are really different from yours, but they're just as important. Yeah. And so that's all she could think of to say about them, and that's basically all I could get out of her. I don't think that she felt a connection to those children because they're so different from her, but that's an age thing too. I mean, that's an age thing too. But I wasn't going to go in there and have her have comments about those children. We just let those photographs stand and be their own commentary. What I found interesting as an adult, and if it had been my book, I would have written about it, those kids all make eye contact with the camera, and most of the other kids do not. And I thought that was really interesting. they really are very present in the moment, you know, and they don't have defenses. And I was very struck by that with those kids. But for her, they were too different to really connect with. But the others, yeah, this was, you know, it was a lot of what she really felt and believed about the kids and the older kids and the city kids and her place there.
Could you tell me the title book and then just briefly just describe the book?
Ying Ying's book is called Kids Like Me in China, and she wrote it about her first trip back to visit her orphanage in the city where that orphanage is. When she was 7.5 to 8 years old, the project took us about 6 months to complete. And she starts with a little introduction of herself as a person who was born in China and adopted by Americans and growing up in San Francisco. And then she starts with the youngest children at the orphanage, the healthy infants, which is what she was when she lived there. And she describes what their life is like, and she pays a lot of attention to the people who take care of them and what they do, and things like, you know, they're working so hard that they don't get to sit down for lunch. They stand up for lunch, and there aren't many of them, and there are a whole lot of babies. And then she talks about playing with the toddlers and what they like to do, and thinks about how they're, the healthy kids, most of them are girls, the little ones are girls, and why that would be. And that was a lot of work, because it's a very complicated situation with different population policies for rural people and for city people. And she worked hard on getting a grasp of that in a very simple but straightforward and fairly accurate way. And then she talks about the big kids who go to school in the city, and they're the ones she was most interested in. And she talks a little bit about the disabled kids. And then she goes out into the city because she's made some friends in the city who live in their families or growing up in their families. And their lives have a lot of similarities to hers. They live in small apartments, but they have all sorts of modern stuff, you know, computers and music, entertainment centers and all that kind of stuff. And she was able to visit a school as well and have a big party with kids at a primary school, a public elementary school in her city. And that was really a lot of fun. And she really enjoyed visiting them and has gone back and visited them several times since then. And finally, she talks just a little bit about going out into the countryside and what's different out there. About how she wants to come back and be able to belong in both places.
Do you have anything you'd like to add?
I do. Okay. And that relates to...
The whole interview I talked about.
Sure. Yeah. In part related to everything and that we've been talking about and to her book especially. As proud as I am of her and of Amy for making the book, I'm just enormously proud of her for what she's done after. Mm-hmm. We were really pleased that people accepted the book and she earned some royalties with it. We were prepared to set aside the money for her college and college fees, and she made the determination that she wanted to give money back to the kids in her orphanage to help them go to school, because she said it's their story as much as it is mine, and they deserve the money just as much as I do. And that's something that I just didn't expect out of a kid of her age, to think that way. And I just think that's really great. And she started with getting eyeglasses for these kids. She bought air conditioners so they had a good study room. And now she's putting nearly 20 kids through school, and including a couple of kids who are going to vocational schools and college. And for her as an 11-year-old to do that, I say, wow, that's great. I'm just really happy about that.
And I would say one other thing is that she's not alone in this. I think there are quite a few kids who are finding, who are her age or younger, who are finding ways to make a real difference and are becoming empowered to help make the situation better for children who are living in orphanages now. And I think that's tremendously important and for them personally, probably more than what our any of us is able to contribute, because the need is so enormous and we can't possibly make a good life for every orphanage child in China. That's not possible. But the point is that young children and quite a few of them, by doing readathons, by, you know, donating checks that they've received for birthday presents, are dedicating those what they can to help make life better for children like themselves who are growing up in orphanages. And I think that's fantastic. And I also think what one of the things that we wanted to accomplish with the book was to make it clear that even pretty young kids have a lot to say about their lives. And we parents, we talk a lot, like I do, but we need to start turning the story over to them. It will change, you know, they won't always have the same view of it that they have at 7 or 8, and it's not over at 16 or 26 or 36, it's never over. But that they are the storytellers of their own lives, and that they are, they have a voice and they can use it. And I think that's really important. I don't think that children should have to wait until they're all grown up and moved out of home and have a degree that says that they're competent to be able to tell the world what their life is like. I hope that we hear from lots more of these kids as they grow up, because I think they all have a lot to say, and I look forward to hearing those stories.
Okay, my last question. I don't know what you said already. Is there anything you'd like to add, or is it all done?
No. No, I think we've exhausted you.
No. It was great. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, man.
Thank you.
I do want to add something. I want to say how moved I am that adoptees are included in this story of Asian immigration in the United States. It's a little bit different in that our children didn't choose to come here, but they came here nonetheless. And I am so grateful to see them included as part of the story of immigration from Asia to the United States, because they belong there. They belong to the history of Asian America and the future of Asian America.